Humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance program link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Unlawful and unfair. This is how experts refer to Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian judiciary official who has been in detention in Sweden for the past 2 years over alleged prisoner abuse in 1988. Here in Iran, this group of law experts have gathered to examine the rights violations Sweden has committed against Hamid Nouri for charging him without solid evidence.
None of those who testified against Mr. Nouri were eyewitnesses. They have never been in touch with him. So Stockholm's court should have not involved itself in false accusations leveled against Mr. Nouri by a terrorist entity. The Swedish justice system is violating international law by interfering in another country's judicial system.
The suit was lodged by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or shortly MKO, a formidable terror group responsible for most of the assassinations that have targeted Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The terror group claims that Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of its members in 1988. The Swedish prosecutor has charged Nouri with war crimes and crimes against humanity, something which the ex-Iranian official dismisses as imaginary. These people say MKO itself has committed countless war crimes with impunity.
MKO terrorists have the blood of some 17,000 Iranians on their hands. They assisted former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his 8-year war against Iran. They have committed thousands of war crimes and must be punished by the international legal systems. Yet we see that Sweden simply ignores the MKO crimes and instead accuses a retired Iranian judicial clerk of war crimes.
Swedish prosecutors have now requested the maximum penalty of life imprisonment for Hamid Nouri. The final verdict is scheduled to be handed down to Nouri on July 14th.
It seems that the entire case is a political campaign aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's judicial system. I think if the Swedish judiciary pursues righteousness, it will vindicate Mr. Nouri of all the charges.
Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. Nouri, now 61, has been held in solitary confinement for over 2 years now.
Experts here say Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri follows baseless allegations made by a terrorist organization, and therefore it has no legal grounds. They asked Sweden to immediately release the Iranian national. Otherwise, they say, it could be construed that the Swedish judicial system is swayed by the MKO terror group. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 6-year-old girl lies in her coffin. Her name is Alina. She was killed by Ukrainian army shelling of the Donetsk region. Her family and the local community mourn together. As she's taken away to the burial site, her grandmother bids farewell to her beloved granddaughter for the last time. She asks for forgiveness. Now, Alina was killed. Speaking to locals and the family, they tell me that she was killed because of a Ukrainian shell that was fired in this direction. and an anti-air defence missile fired by the Russians hit that missile in the mid-air, and shrapnel showered to the ground to kill Alina. There was the massive boom of the anti-air defence working. Alina didn't die straight away. She was taken to hospital and died 2 days later. The clock is stopped at 6:12, the moment Alina's heart stopped beating. She arrives at the burial site. Her family say their final goodbyes. Now, there's something particularly shocking about a child killed in war. Few people here can hold back the tears. While millions of people in NATO countries continue to encourage their governments to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of negotiating for peace, the fact of the matter is, the longer this war goes on, the more children like Alina will be killed. A memorial in Donetsk. The sign reads, "To the children killed in Donbass since 2014. There is no end date, as children continue to die. Mourners take their turn to pay their final respects. For 8 years, Ukraine has targeted and killed civilians here in Donetsk. President Zelensky, lionized in the West for defending European values, has continued the policy. Alina's whole life was lived during this war, a war now escalated by the Russian invasion and NATO's policy of arming Ukraine instead of pushing for negotiations. This is the true reality of war." Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
To the southeast of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina exists a cemetery that is the most famous and holiest in the Islamic world, Jannatul Baqi, meaning the Garden of Heaven. After the dawn prayers, the gates of Baqi are opened for a few hours, and crowds of Muslim pilgrims flock to it. Baqi is the main burial ground for the people of Medina since the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and contains graves of many of the Prophet Muhammad's family and companions.
In order to describe the importance of Baqi Cemetery, I have to say it is a rendezvous of thousands of Muslims every day.
Baqi is honored to host the tombs of four infallible Imams, Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon them. Today, there is no trace of the shrine that used to contain their tombs. Close to the graves are the remains of the House of Sorrows, a place where the Prophet's daughter, Lady Fatima, used to come to and shed tears of grief over the loss of her father.
When we enter in Mazari Baqiya, when we enter Mantwari Baqiya, there you become very, you know, emotional.
It is also believed that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, often prayed in Baqi whenever he was passing through.
Baqi is like no other cemetery in the world of Islam. It's a place of absolute sanctity for all Muslims. Therefore, Hajj pilgrims every year visit this place to pay tribute to the relatives and companions of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agreed today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
È una vergogna.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector. The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month. Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
As part of my visit program to Medina, I visited the first mosque in the world that dates to the lifetime of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the 7th century CE. With its shining white minarets, the Quba Mosque is a sacred place of worship for Muslims.
It's believed that it was built by the prophet himself in the city of Medina following his migration from Mecca to this city. Therefore, this mosque holds a very special place in the hearts of Muslim devotees.
Quba Mosque is the second largest and most prestigious mosque in the city after the Prophet's Mosque. It's a unique landmark and its white building can be clearly seen from a distance. The mosque has gone through several rounds of renovation during the years and now has 4 minarets and 56 domes. This mosque is said to be where the first Friday prayer was held, led by the Holy Prophet Muhammad. It holds value to millions of Muslims around the world who wish to visit it at least once in their lifetime. The Islamic traditions have highly recommended performing prayers in this mosque.
Whoever performs ablutions in one's home and offers one prayer in Quba Mosque will be rewarded the equivalent of one umrah.
At the end of my visit, I joined pilgrims from several countries in the courtyard of the mosque for eating food votives, pieces of bread, yogurt, dates and coffee are the simple treats that Muslims offer to pilgrims to thank God or in the memory of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
Germany, home to the second biggest Muslim community in Western Europe after France. It's also home to a growing number of racist attacks on Muslims by neo-Nazis and far-right extremists. Rights group FAIR International, which has founded Germany's first reporting center for attacks on mosques, has recorded nearly 840 such incidents since 2014. A case in point, the horrifying 2014 arson attack that gutted Berlin's Mevlana Mosque. German police are usually quick to show up on the scene, but in most cases, FAIR International says, the crimes are not properly investigated.
Just 10% they find the people who have done it. So 90%, and they knew maybe who has done it. And that shows that even the government, the police, and some people of the government are together with them.
The attacks are not limited to Muslim places of worship. Physical assaults on Muslim men and women are also an almost daily occurrence.
A 2019 study found that more than half of Germans view Islam as a threat. In the same year, nearly 1,000 incidents were reported against Muslims and institutions. And in 2020, at least one Muslim individual or mosque was either physically assaulted or received death threats almost every day.
Another report published in 2020 criticizes many European states for failing to report on anti-Muslim incidents as a separate category of hate crime.
This plan is against Islam. Everything is planned. And in Germany, the fruits, because of our history, of course, we do have people who are racist. I don't know how much percent. And that is in whole Europe.
Despite all the warnings and criticism, anti-Muslim hatred, fueled by the propaganda of new Nazi groups and the far-right opposition parties, has only grown, a reality that does not bode well for the country's nearly 5 million Muslims. Sahih Puriza, London.
Limelight. One campaigner said the cursory approval of more than 3,500 drilling permits contradicts President Biden's pledges to address the terrifying threat of climate change. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Groups Sue Biden Administration for Threatening Climate-Impaired Wildlife with Drilling Permits. Stay tuned for more. Citing a trio of federal laws, environmental organizations sued the Biden administration recently for further jeopardizing climate-imperiled species by issuing more than 3,500 oil and gas drilling permits on public lands in New Mexico and Wyoming. The Biden administration is literally drilling away the climate, declared Jeremy Nicholas, director of the Climate and Energy Program at Wild Earth Guardians, one of the groups behind the new suit filed in a federal court in Washington, D.C. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under fire from campaigners for not only failing to deliver on climate-related campaign pledges, including a vow to end new federal fossil fuel leasing, but also outpacing his predecessor for permit approvals during his first year in office. Today's lawsuit is about enforcing the reality that more oil and gas extraction only stands to fuel the climate crisis, contrary to the promises of President Biden, Nicholas said recently. The lawsuit targets Biden's Interior Department and an agency within it, the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, as well as the leaders of each, arguing that the administration's drilling permit approvals violate the Endangered Species Act, the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, and the National Environmental Policy Act. Fossil fuels are driving the extinction crisis, and the Bureau of Land Management is making things worse by failing to protect these imperiled species, asserted Brett Harl, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, another group behind the case. Holt said the agency's cursory approval of more than 3,500 drilling permits contradicts President Biden's pledges to address the terrifying threat of the climate change. Every new well takes polar bears and many other species one step closer to extinction. Kyle Tisdell of the Western Environmental Law Center, who filed the suit recently, highlighted the disconnect between the need for climate action now and the administration's decisions. The climate crisis is happening now, causing harms that are disproportionately felt by environmental justice communities, and it requires immediate action in order to maintain a livable planet, Tisdell said, noting the federal oil and gas program's planet-heating emissions. While President Biden has acknowledged the urgency of this crisis, it is time for action to align with rhetoric, the attorney continued, adding, the Bureau of Land Management has admitted that continued oil and gas exploitation is a significant cause of the climate crisis, yet the agency continues to recklessly issue thousands of new oil and gas drilling permits, violating its duty to prevent unnecessary and undue degradation of public lands. The suit specifically references a 2020 BLM report that estimates emissions from coal, oil and gas development that is occurring and is projected to occur on public lands. The case comes as scientists highlight the connections between the climate emergency and biodiversity crisis, with one paper published earlier this month in the journal Bioscience warning that as the window to avoid far-reaching and irreversible impacts on people and nature rapidly closes, the current actions to address these global challenges are insufficient. The New York Times reported recently that the case, which uses a novel legal argument involving federal law designed to protect endangered wildlife, faces long odds, but experts called it an ambitious effort that could force the government to rethink how it evaluates the potential for climate harm from each new drilling permit. As the newspaper explained, the suit turns on invalidating decisions that rely on a 2008 legal opinion written by David Bernard, who was chief counsel at the Department of Interior under President George W. Bush and will later run the agency in the Trump administration. Mr. Bernard declared that the Interior Department does not have an obligation to study the impact on an endangered plant or animal from a proposed action that would add carbon emissions to the atmosphere. Science cannot say that a tiny incremental global temperature rise that might be produced by an action under consideration would manifest itself in the location of a listed species or its habitat, Mr. Bernard wrote at the time. That position still largely holds true, scientists and environmentalists said. But they also said it's an impossible standard, like requiring knowledge of which packet of cigarettes triggered a smoker's lung cancer. It's totally wrong to think about it, University of Arizona professor John J. Vienz told the Times, adding, more emissions, more warming puts species at risk. It doesn't matter if we don't know that this specific well in Wyoming led to an extinction. We know what the general pattern is.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As the fallout from the Ukraine conflict intensifies with soaring energy and food prices driving up global inflation, the U.S. President Joe Biden and his officials from the Group of Seven rich nations have pledged to have more economic sanctions be exercised on Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. has delivered more aid, with the latest to possibly include sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Ukraine is losing this almost four-month-old war, even though the U.S. and its allies have placed sanctions and given Ukraine immense military aid. But first, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us is journalist, activist, and political analyst John Busnish, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Richard Becker, if I may. The G7 statement, one of them, is that Washington is planning to send these sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles, which is obviously accompanied by, well, the list is rather long. I'll go back to a month ago, U.S. doubles military aid. 1 week ago, $1 billion more U.S. military aid. And 3 days ago, another $450 million in military aid. Why is Ukraine losing this war if all this military aid and equipment is being delivered to it?
Well, of course, most of that money is actually, has to be pointed out, most of that money is actually just going directly to the arms makers in the United States, who, for whom this is a an unexpected bonanza. And that which is going to Ukraine is going to military, which is only been able to continue the war because of this tremendous injection of outside aid coming from the U.S. and from the other NATO partners, whose aim, and it must be pointed out, whose aim is to weaken Russia. That was said by the U.S. Secretary of War, Lloyd Austin. They call it defense, but it's really the War Department. And he said that a few weeks ago.
I'm glad you mentioned that, if I may jump in. What does it mean to weaken Russia? What is the U.S. Define that for us, if you can.
Well, it's to prolong the war. And so what that really means is that the U.S. leaders are willing to fight to the last Ukrainian to achieve their real objective, which is not defending democracy. You know, no one can believe defending democracy or human rights, given the real record of the United States around the world. That's what it is. At the end of 2017, and it was ratified, I believe, in early 2018, was the latest iteration of the National Security Strategy, which comes up for every 4 years or 6 years or 8 years. And that one said that the main focus of U.S. foreign policy and military policy had shifted from fighting terrorism to major power competition, major power conflict. That can only mean conflict with Russia and China in the world that we live in today. And that conflict, in order to maintain U.S. domination and to extend U.S. domination, so as part of that strategy, that national security strategy, we have to see this war as one that's aimed at weakening one of those powers that the U.S. can compete with them.
John Bosnich, I could read down the list of all the things that the U.S., European partners, and NATO member countries by default have done in terms of aid, whether it's militarily or otherwise, to Ukraine. But as our guest there says, the aim is to weaken Russia. What does it mean to weaken Russia? What do they want to see? At what point is that the definition of a Russia that's weakened?
Well, first of all, they're not going to weaken Russia at all. The size of this conflict is minor compared to the full military resources of Russia. Weaken Russia is the propaganda story being told to the American public so that they will approve or at least acquiesce to this massive waste of taxpayer funds. What the real aim is to spend old weapons, use up old munitions which are coming to their expiry date, use up weaponry that the United States already considers to be obsolete, later charge the Ukrainians for that if they survive the war, and blame it all on Russia. What it is a corporate ripoff of the American taxpayer using Ukrainians, as your other guest said, as cannon fodder.
Richard Becker, when you take a look at the G7, I mean, our guest there talks about the American public to be convinced. Let's just look at the G7, where you have five of these emerging powers trying to build this support amongst each other. Now, we're talking about just that group. But three of them have actually failed to condemn Russia when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, India, Senegal, and South Africa. So what does that show if they can't have their own members be convinced, if they're sitting on the fence at a minimum, when it comes to this conflict?
Well, I think that it's clear that there are different interests among these powers. I mean, first of all, we should ask the question, what is the G7 and why does it even exist? I mean, it's an association under U.S. domination, under U.S. leadership, of the leading, what I would call, our imperialist powers in the world today. Those powers are, several of them are still occupied by the United States. Here we are coming up on 80 years after the end of World War II, and there are a huge deployment of U.S. military still in Germany and in Japan, and U.S. bases in Britain and in Canada and in Italy. And the only one that doesn't have U.S. bases, as far as I know, but collaborates with the U.S. military is France. So what is this organization? Why does it exist? It exists to further the aims and the objectives of these powers, these big powers that have been the colonizing powers for the most part in the world over the last centuries. And they continue to be the dominant powers in much of the world. It does not mean, as your question infers, that they all have exactly the same interest. And some are in danger as the war goes on and if more and more sanctions, it's hard to see how they can have more sanctions. They've had six or seven rounds of them so far. but that those, particularly in Europe, that are dependent on gas and from Russia, run a much greater danger to their economies than, say, the United States does, which doesn't import any or much gas from Russia.
So when we take a look at the way that the G7 countries, and then in a larger scale, John Bosnich, the European countries, for example, even countries around the world, are actually conducting themselves when it comes to Russia and its commodities. Why don't we take a look at, for example, when the 100 days of the war passed, how we're looking at countries that have contributed to Russia earning 93 billion euros in revenue from fossil fuel exports. Now, I could look down this list, which includes the EU, I'll leave the rest out, which imported 61% of that, worth approximately 57 billion euros. What's going on? I thought Russia was sanctioned, but they're continuing to buy?
Well, this is the bigger picture and the more important picture. There is no doubt that Russia is going to win the conflict in Ukraine. It is going to secure the areas of ethnic Russian population inside Ukraine. That's never been in any kind of doubt. What has been in doubt is the ability of the United States to keep its military colonies in line. And when I say military colonies, I'm referring to the EU, to Canada, to Japan, and to the other countries that form the American power base, the military power base. This is, up until now, it has been tough to do. And there have been certain examples of countries that simply have not obeyed the sanctions because to do so would shut down their economies completely. As the conflict goes longer, these cracks in the NATO and EU infrastructure will become more serious. If Russia maintains the pressure, and if America continues to insist on these countries to do its bidding, the crack is going to come on the Western side. We're going to see a break in the EU, and we're going to see a refusal to comply with NATO orders by NATO countries. And that is the real aim of Russia's operation in Ukraine. They are not content with just neutralizing Ukraine. Russia is aiming to neutralize NATO as a threat to this country.
We have heard this before, Richard Becker, where many analysts say that European countries, they're vassal states of the U.S., that the U.S. is leading this war, that it's the U.S. that they're succumbing to, that they are bending in order to please, that's the wrong word, but to go along with the U.S. for whatever it is that they see that they need to have this, that they have to follow. I don't want to say orders, but that they're following the U.S. lead. Is that really the case? Are they being forced? Are they being told? And what type of context is that being told to them, if it's true?
Well, I think that there are different realities for different countries. Britain, the British ruling class decided a long time ago that they were going to be the junior partners of the U.S., and they've done whatever the U.S. has been doing, and they've followed in the path. And we can see that over and over and over again over the years. Japan is occupied by many, many U.S. military bases and goes along with what the U.S. wants to do. Some of the other countries chafe under this writ of U.S. power. And I would say that's particularly Germany and France. But they also continue to fall into line and fell into line after having differences once the military operation began on February, the Russian military operation began on February 24th. How long they stay together is another question. And I do think that the contradictions that they have are being exacerbated as the war goes on. So there's a very, I think, very real possibility of more cracks. At the same time, we have to remember that a bigger target for the U.S., for the U.S. leaders, is actually China. And they're constructing what is a de facto NATO in the Pacific, and they now call the Indo-Pac region, the quote-unquote first island chain countries, Japan, Okinawa, Philippines, Borneo, Taiwan, are being organized militarily for war with China. So we have that reality. And there's also a discussion inside NATO of NATO expanding more into Asia. But a number of military alliances, official and unofficial, exist there too.
Okay. We're going to talk about that in a minute too. I think you're referring to what's now been called the Asian NATO, as opposed to the Arab NATO. I'm not too sure where that stands, whether it fell flat and was on life support or was in a coma and maybe brought back to life. I'm not too sure. Anyways, let's look at what John Busnich, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, has said. He said that they have to help him. The world powers are urged to do their most because he wants this to end by the end of the year. That's roughly in about 6 months, if I'm not mistaken. And then what do you have as a response? The NATO Secretary General saying that we're going to, strengthen the Rapid Reaction Force, nearly eightfold to 300,000 troops from 40,000. And then the National Security Advisor of the U.S., Jake Sullivan, said that in securing an advantageous position for Zelensky, this conflict is not going to go on then for years. What do you think when you put those time frames together in one piece?
Well, the conflict can be dragging on along the borders of the territory that Russia takes control over along the Black Sea coast. It is possible that there could be an unresolved or a frozen conflict that could drag on for some time. But the offensive that's taking place now, the full-scale, gradual pincer operation to eliminate the Ukrainian fighting ability, that will not proceed through the winter. Then when winter comes in those regions, it's time to hunker down and hold the lines that you've got. So it's wishful thinking on the part of NATO that there might be some long-term conflict going past December. However, Russia is going to secure its target areas and its objectives in this war no later than October, because Russia is very familiar with their own winters and with the climate situation in the area. And one thing I wanted to mention in response to your earlier remarks, in fact, it is an order that is received from the United States. I worked as an advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister's office, and I worked as an advisor to members of the Canadian government. And I can tell you that in both cases, orders come down from Washington, and there's no as an option. The option is, will we do it today or will we do it tomorrow? And America is giving orders.
Well, why is that? What if they don't?
There are so many levers of sanctions and hidden pressures and financial pressures that the United States exercises through the World Bank and through the International Monetary Fund and through the dumping of foreign countries' currencies. If the United States wants to bring the EU into line, they will crush the euro. They will bring Europe to its knees economically. So we still have a master and servant relationship in Europe. We have Germany continuing to be physically, militarily occupied by America. America is an occupying power of Germany till today, and America is an occupying power of Japan till today. Mm-hmm. And these are the realities that America does not like to talk about, and these are the realities that I have to admit can only be talked about on television networks like your own.
Well, let me refer to the G7 here, Richard Becker. There was a soundbite that I just listened to right before this broadcast that had the U.S. President Joe Biden sitting next to his counterpart, Olaf Scholz. And he kept repeating, he said, without you, we could not have done that. And he started out by saying that we need to stay together, again, trying to make sure that everybody is united in this. But the fact that he was saying that to Olaf Scholz, and the fact that Olaf Scholz said, we are with you. We are going to continue with this. I'm curious how that works out, because both, at a minimum, if not Germany, especially Germany, they are suffering economically. I mean, there's gas shortages that are going to hit that country so hard. and many have deducted that for the winter season, it's not going to be pretty there.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, the reason that they need to say we got to stay united is because they're worried that they're not going to stay united and that it's going to, the whole thing could start to fall apart. I did want to mention, you know, that the G7 was for a period of time called the G8, and Russia was included in it. After Russia went along with the U.S., when they backed away from support for Yugoslavia in the Yugoslavia war, and when the U.S. when China and Russia didn't vote against the U.S. NATO war against Libya, you know, Russia could be in. But when 2014 came around and Russia had to resist what was an existential threat of Ukraine being brought into NATO, well, then they were no longer in the G8, and it became once again the G7.
Final question to John Busnich in about a minute. CIA agents operating in Ukraine made news a few days back, helping Kiev forces with vast amounts of intelligence. What is the CIA doing there exactly?
Well, I mean, it goes far beyond that. The CIA is actually running the government of Ukraine. Zelensky is literally a joker or a puppet on a string. His every move is scripted by the CIA and by the State Department. He was selected by the U.S. government. He was put in power by the U.S. government along with one of the oligarchs, Kolomoisky, who took him right off the airwaves as a TV comedian. And thought, well, this guy has a high enough rating that we can put him in the seat and let him be the puppet that we run. The CIA runs Ukraine. It runs the Ukrainian government, it runs the Ukrainian economy, and it runs the Ukrainian army. And that is the reality that has to be discussed, because the idea that the CIA is calling somebody and asking for favors simply is not the case. The CIA, with the State Department, are in direct control of Ukraine, and the government of Ukraine is nothing but a facade.
We're going to end with that. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, anti-war activists from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker from San Francisco, and thank you, journalist, activist, and political analyst John Busnich, who spoke to us from Belgrade. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, this is goodbye.